Hello and welcome to Southeast Native Radio. Tonight we present the third in a three-part series of the Fred Paul interviews. Tonight Fred Paul talks about his involvement with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement. Andy Hope is the interviewer.
What about your participation in ANCSA? When did you first get involved in the Native land claims effort?
I got involved in the what ultimately became the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act as such. Of course, I had all these Indian cases ahead of time, but for this particular problem, Charlie Anderson Jr. and Guy O'Cockrook and the Reverend Samuel Simmons wrote a letter to my father in early 1966, early January, and said, we want you to protect the rights of the Arctic Slope Eskimos because oil is moving in and there's drilling rigs all over. Well, my father was, 81 then. So he came to me. My dad was living in Seattle then. He came to me and wanted me to help him. I was very reluctant, but finally I did. And I wrote to the Indian office and asked for their standard form of attorney's contract and sent it up to Barrow for execution. It's very involved to get legal authority to represent an Indian tribe. The BIA has to have a monitor on it when it's executed. They have to supply the form and you submit it to the local BIA, who sends it back to the commissioner, who sends it over to the solicitor, and blah, blah, blah. Well, it took 2 solid years for my approval, for the approval of my contract, but it was approved. Meantime, I went to work. And things were pretty quiet in 1966. I did some work, some studying. But all of a sudden, in the fall of 66, fall of 1966, things erupted. I was happy with my life in Seattle. And one morning I read in the Post Intelligencer, the Secretary of the Interior was going to offer for leasing 4.5 million more acres on the North Slope to oil people for development. Man alive, that's the land of my clients. So I wrote a letter to the secretary. What in the world are you doing? You know, by this time we filed a claim with the Bureau of Land Management covering the whole slope, 56.5 million acres, everything north of the 60th parallel. Well, I didn't have a legal description of a land actually to be offered for leasing, but eventually the proper documents came to Seattle and I was able to look it up, and sure enough it was. It covered North Slope lands over by Point Hope, what I call the Point Hope sale. And I wrote a bunch of letters protesting it, informed my clients, and I was gearing up for a lawsuit to enjoin the Secretary of the Interior to offering that sale prior to the disposition of the blanket claims, the blanket claims being based upon Aboriginal rights. All of this, you know, I fully documented in my book, you know, with names, dates, and places, and who I wrote to, and so forth. Well, as the sale was set for November 18th, 1966, and I was busy with this kind of stuff, and busy drafting complaints, and I wanted to have some help appear in Alaska, so I wrote Mike Stepovich, former governor up here, to see if he'd give me a hand, and some other lawyers. And one Sunday night, around the 14th of October, I got a phone call from Hugh Nichols and Jules Wright. Hugh representing the Eskimos and Jules Wright, president of the Fairbanks Native Association. And they wanted me to come north And Joel said that he'd provide $500 for airplane ticket. Fine. I told him he wanted me to come north the next day. There's going to be a big conference. Fine. I told him that I could get up there Tuesday, but not Monday. Well, I think the guy has masticated that all night long, in typical Alaskan style, and I was awakened about 5:30, 6 o'clock Monday morning, and he was on the phone again. Fred, he says, I want you up here. I told Jules, your few hours ago, I'd be up Tuesday. Not good enough. Anyway, I was up there Monday afternoon. The convention opened Tuesday morning. It was known as the First Chiefs Conference. I think Emil Nadi is one of the spark plugs that called the meeting. And Charlie Anderson Jr. was then working for the OEO agency and had charge of writing travel requests for the agency on the federal government. I think he wrote 80 of them. I'm not sure he had authority, but at least they were issued and it worked. So we had 150 people there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had invited Robert Bennett, then Commissioner of Indian Affairs, to attend. Stan McCutcheon was active, and I'd known Stan forever and ever. I'd heard rumor that he had a bill. I was trying to find Stan and see if I could see what the bill was. Big secret. Never did see it, at least Monday night I didn't. Tuesday morning, the convention opens. And Emil parcels everybody out on and committees. Well, I went to the land committee. Ed Unichols was there, Dan McCutcheon, Cliff Grohl, and Cliff Grohl had drafted the proposed bill that he and Stan were going to suggest that the First Chief Conference endorse. Well, the bill was for money. What Cliff had done was he had copied the Indian Claims Commission Act of 1946. And, of course, that act was authorizing most any tribe that wanted to utilize it to sue the United States in the Indian Claims Commission for money,
mm-hmm,
for some alleged transgression. I looked at that, and my mind went back to my brother Bill's thesis, you know. And I said to Stan, that's real good for lands lost, but it's my view that for 90% of Alaska, the Indians have not lost their land. They still own it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was sort of nonplussed. So I said, let's amend it. Let's put in a paragraph in there that we get paid for the lands lost, and we ask the court to define by meets and bounds, white man style, the lands still in existence, still owned by the respective native tribes. It was tribal. Not statewide, it was tribal. Each tribe would have his respective land defined still in ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And that became the policy of the First Chief Conference. But just supposing the First Chief Conference had endorsed the idea, recognizing that all of their lands had been lost, and so please pay us in cash. Natives don't want money. They want their land.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it could have been a fatal mistake. Well, you still had the Point Hope sale to worry about. Oh, a little cute story about Robert Bennett. There were seven guys from the slope, and it was the first time I really met them in the fall of 66. There was one guy there, a young man, who had been trained in the National Guard, about 6 feet two, slender, handsome, straight as an arrow. You know, he learned how to read maps, you know. And his name is Art Umatuk. And so I said, you know, to my gang, I said, you know, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs is here. He's going to give a speech. Just supposing, after his speech, we get a chance to talk. I want you guys to appoint somebody to be your spokesman. And I want him to get up and, so to speak, raise holy hell with the commissioner for participating in another rape of the North Slope lands. I'm not entirely sure of their choice of Art as their spokesman was the proper one, but Art made quite a presentation. In due course, you know, the commissioner talked, and in a due course, Imanati, as presiding officer, says, now, if there are any questions. Upshot, Art. And he's uptight. He's, I won't say hysterical, but his questions were based on a reference that the commissioner knew all about the land transaction. So it went this way. What are you doing to our land? What are you doing to our land? You know, and the commissioner was thrown back. And he says to an assistant, is there another land withdrawal up in the North Slope? Of course there was, 4.5 million acres. I don't know whether Robert Bennett ever helped us back in Washington or not. I rather believe that the Bureau, the Commissioner's Office, is a different country than the Secretary's Office. It's something like in the Navy, you have the non-coms and the common sailors area of life, and you have the wardroom. It's a different country.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure the commissioner talked to the secretary ever, but whatever. I never saw any indication that Bennett helped us at all. None at all. Well, I still had that problem. I had written to the Association on American Indian Affairs, with whom the Pauls had been very friendly in times past, when Laverne Madigan was the executive director, and when Charles, sometimes known as Carl Russell, was the executive director. We were very close to them. So I turned to them in late September when the sale was announced for some help in trying to get some clout with the Secretary of the Interior. By this time, they had a guy by the name of William Byler. I don't know where he came from, but he took an instant dislike to me, but he's always had to work with, so I kept writing him and asking him to help me intercede with the secretary. And I wrote some more letters, and I prepared a complaint, and I got Mike Stepovich cranked up a little bit. Eventually, I learned that our protests were being heard by the secretary, and in mid-November, just before the sale, proposed sale, Udall wrote a letter saying that the mechanics of the sale should go forward, but there would be no award, and forbade any further transactions through the Bureau of Land Management about any land in the public domain to anybody throughout the whole state.
Mm-hmm.
And that became what we call the informal land freeze. What my participation in that is pretty hard to define. The Senate Committee in 1970 issued a report, Senate Committee did, on the history of the Alaskan land claims movement. And in it, the Senate Committee said that because of the protest by the Alaska Natives, the Secretary of the Interior in the fall of 66 No, that was still while you all were secretary. That report must have been issued in 68. In any event, there is such a report. The Senate committee said, because of the protest by the Alaska Natives, the Secretary of the Interior in the fall of 1966 opposed all land transactions. I rather believe that the Senate committee was talking about my protests.
Mm-hmm.
I have no evidence to the contrary. And of course, that was one of our great bargaining weapons. And, I'm most disturbed about Wally Hickles as governor, and particularly as governor, and Ernest Greenings as senator, raising holy hell on the secretary that the land freeze was illegal, Edgar Paul Boyko illegal and contrary to law, disobeying the Congress, as exemplified in the Alaska Statehood Act. Hickel and Boyko and Greening wanted the state to proceed with its authority to make selections under the Alaska Statehood Act. The Alaska Statehood Act gave the state authority to select 103 million acres, providing, and this is the part white men always forgets, providing they do not impinge on Indian rights.
Mm-hmm.
But, the Alaska Statehood Act and the Alaska Constitution provides for a promise by the formal state government and by its citizens, and every one of its citizens, that they will forever not disturb Indian property.
Mm-hmm.
In words. It's okay for Bob Atwood to disregard that promise that Congress said he must give in order to accept statehood. That's okay. It's all right for Wally Hickel to just disregard that promise. That's okay. But of course, in law, it isn't. And in justice, it is not.
You mentioned earlier that there was a difference of opinion on legislative strategy on the Alaska Native Claims lobbying effort in the late 60s.
I think I can illustrate the conflict that we had internally, to some extent externally, by relating to Arthur J. Goldberg's approach. My philosophy, beginning back in 66, in this last struggle, was that the natives of Alaska had legal rights to their land, and that if the United States Congress wanted to expropriate the rights of the natives to their land, that they should pay fair value for the land so taken as of the date of taking, which in my view had not yet occurred. I was alone in that effort, in that rationale, until February of 69, when the Federal Field Committee report came out. And it said flatly that as to 275 million acres, the Alaska Natives had, quote, a substantial claim, unquote, to those acres out of the 375 million acres in Alaska, the exception being such places as cities and Fort Richardson and the few military reservations, areas like that. We had no quarrel with excluding patented land. But the patented lands in Alaska and federal withdrawals didn't really amount to that much in the total picture. Tongass National Forest had to be excluded because that was, the court held, an expropriation. It's funny about Indian rights, Indian property rights. Whenever some sovereignty, like a city, wants to build a highway through somebody's home and take the home, society has one ready answer. What is the value of the home? Society doesn't worry about the position of the homeowner in society, whether he's a billionaire or a ne'er-do-well or a drunk or whatever. That's irrelevant. What society does worry about is what is the value of the home. That was my view, that they should pay fair value as of the time of taking. So now we have Arthur J. Goldberg.
Well, Goldberg was hired. What was the reasoning behind hiring him? Was they needed some internationally respected celebrity to head up the effort? Or?
I gave major speeches, formal speeches, as well as writing in my essays, and as well as private conversations, that basically the lobbying effort on the part of the Alaska Natives during 66, 67, and 68 was basically a failure. The AFN leadership didn't approach the president until Don Wright became president in the fall of 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in the AFN structure approached the president of the United States to inform him or to request his assistance. So I believe I'm correct in saying that the AFN lobbying effort was a failure. Oh yeah, we're creating a little storm, but one must remember that the United States traditionally has believed in manifest destiny. It has the authority to deprive Indians of their ancestral lands. Period. So I gave major speeches saying we needed to have a massive Washington D.C. Lobbying effort. I formed or tried to form combinations among the lawyers and suggested that we each give a small percentage of our fee to a lawyer in Washington, D.C. to head up a lobbying effort. About that time, Roger Connor was appointed to the Supreme Court of the state of Alaska. He had represented the Aleuts. And about that time, young Bob Goldberg, I've always been amused. I suppose there are places farther from New York City than Anchorage, but not many. Anyway, he left, as far as I can figure out, to go to the farthest place he could think of, away from New York City, and therefore his stamping grounds and his home country. So he arrives in Anchorage and goes to work for Les Miller. Les is a pretty good lawyer. He's a Cornell graduate. Floyd Lechenoff said, you know, if we hire Les Miller as our lawyer for the Aleuts, maybe through his new associate, Bob, he can get his dad to join us. Fine. Hey, I'm in favor of that. You know, there's no greater lawyer in the world than Justice Goldberg, Secretary of Labor, attorney for the CIO AFL, actually managed the merger of the AFL-CIO, ambassador to the United Nations, justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Fine. I don't know who approached Justice Goldberg, but that was in late February of 69. By the end of March, he had agreed to come north. We had a big meeting at Anchorage. I went up for it. Tried to talk to the guy. And without any real success. So we're having a meeting at the AFN board on a Friday morning. And Abel Nottie came to me and he said, the justice has asked that all lawyers be excluded. For heaven's sake. I didn't like it, but after all, you know, he is quite an august person. I was in favor of getting somebody like him. Anyway, Cliff Rowland, Stan McCutcheon, the rest of us, we troop out. Next thing we know, the AFN has passed, the board had passed a resolution giving complete authority to Justice Colbert. He had authority to dictate strategy. He had authority to make agreements, binding on the board. The board couldn't overrule him. I'm sure he drafted it, or one of his staff drafted it. You know, he was in a big office. All right. I resolved that I wouldn't pay any attention to that. I had my relationship with my people. I had a contract approved by the Secretary of the Interior, and so forth. So we, the lawyers, say, hey, you know, we want to talk to the guy. All day Saturday passes, or Friday afternoon, evening, Saturday evening. Sunday morning, we get word that we can meet with him at 4 o'clock for an hour and a half. Sunday afternoon. And he has to leave at 5:30 to give some TV broadcast interview. All right. Edgar Paul Boyko had been hired by the Kenaises and Kodiak natives, to be their lawyer. Now, Edgar Paul was also counsel for the state when Hickel filed that lawsuit to abolish the land freeze. Hickel, on behalf of the state, sued Udall to abolish the land freeze. And Boyko, at this time, was counsel for the state in that lawsuit. But that didn't bother Boyko, it didn't bother the Kenaissi Indians. We meet at 4:30, the appointed time, 4 o'clock. And there's about seven or eight of us. I made the mistake of sitting way to the justice's left. And Boyko was on his right. First of all, Goldberg talks for the best part of an hour. So, you know, it leaves us 30, 40 minutes for the rest of us. And tells about his vast experience and how he was buddies with John F. Kennedy and so forth. Fine. Well, he starts with Boyko, and Boyko has never been a slouch for words. I don't know how long Edgar Paul talked, but a long time. And it went all the way around. nobody saying very much. Finally came to my turn, and I had less than 5 minutes. So I started talking about legal rights. And I wanted to get this legal rights theory across to him. And the justice sort of interrupted me. He says, Mr. Paul, you know, all my years in practice and on the court, particularly on the court, you know, we had Indian cases. And I think I know my way around in Indian law. And I said to myself, not out loud, to myself, you know, I don't think he had a single Indian case while he was on the Supreme Court. Not one. When I got back to Seattle, I went through the volumes of the Supreme Court reports. I was mistaken. There was one case that he sat on during his term on the court. He was only on the court for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved some white man who had a store on an Indian reservation. And the white man didn't want to pay some taxes. And so he was suing as to whether or not he had to pay taxes. That was the extent of Goldberg's knowledge of Indian law.
You've been listening to Southeast Native Radio, produced in the studios of KTOO-FM in Juneau. Tonight's third episode of the Fred Paul Interviews concludes that series. Thank you for listening.